We are up to Perikyud Gimel, chapter 13, which I don't expect to complete entirely today. It's a big chapter. But it begins the distribution of the land. Right? In the previous parak, we saw the summary of conquests. We had the explanation about Moshe conquering the eastern side of the Yarden at Hashem's command, and the listing of the kings as a shira of sorts on the western side of the Yarden. And that brings us to Perikyud Gimel. If you take a look at the sheet, you see I gave you a quick outline of what's going on. First, we're told about the distribution of the unconquered land west of the Yarden, in the sense that Yoshua has given an instruction that even though they haven't conquered everything, nonetheless, he should still divide it up for reasons that we'll discuss. Second, we're told about the distribution of the land on the eastern side of the Yarden with a command to divide that up, and then we're told about the land of Reuven, land of God, half of Menasheh, before a statement that Levi doesn't get land, which actually appears twice in this parak for reasons that we have to discuss. But that's the breakdown. Just in order to realize a little bit about what we're talking about, you talk about division of the land, and it kind of doesn't have a lot of meaning for us today. Meaning, as irrelevant as the kings they defeated in the previous chapter were, so that's how relevant the division of who gets what land feels for a Jew today. Like, whether it's Reuven or whether it's Yehuda or whether it's somebody else, how does that affect what we do?
I thought that eventually we're going to go back to those inherited, ancestral lands.
Good question. Hold that question for a couple of minutes, because that's actually a very important question in its own right. But the first practical application of dividing up the land is actually the fact that there is some group that is entitled to divide it up at all. That's entitled to say, you go here, you go there. That's not simple and straightforward. Everybody owns the land. By what right are you just going to say, Yoshua is going to say, this group is going to dwell here and this group is going to dwell there? Now, obviously the answer is, well, God told him to. And that's, generally pretty good as authority goes in Tanakh. But take a look at source number one, where the Gemara actually understands Yoshua's powers of distributing land as a greater power that is inherent in Beis Din. In all rabbinical courts, or I say all, but that's actually not so clear-cut in terms of which courts get this, but take a look. Minayin shehefker based in haya hefker. The Gemara here is actually having a discussion about something completely different. The Gemara, in context, is talking about prosbul. Okay? Prosbul is what? Okay, good. It's a good thing to know about. This year is a Shemitah year, so it's particularly important.
I know what it is. When you say it, I'm sure I'll think.
Okay, does it relate to Shemitah, what you're thinking?
I'm sure.
Okay, so at the end of the Shemitah year, all loans are forgiven.
Oh, right. That's what they spoke about at Olchanat, the new rabbi spoke about. And
okay.
We have to say that sheet, yeah, but I don't remember exactly.
Okay, so as the...
And did the lands go back as well, all that?
Or that's Yovel.
It's the money.
That's
Yovel.
It's the money, correct.
Yeah, just loans only.
Right. Loans are null and void.
Well, all loans that are due before the end of Shemitah. So in other words, this coming Rosh Hashanah, any loan that you had extended to somebody that was due already is void. That's the idea. Now, that created certain problems. Specifically, the problem it creates is then people don't want to lend money.
Right.
As the Torah, in fact, warns. It says, lest you say, well, the seventh year is coming and I don't want to lend people money, don't do that. And, don't do that is a very nice way, to say it. But if there are no teeth to it, then people aren't going to lend money, particularly because, keep in mind, lending money to begin with in Torah is a money-losing proposition. Right? In your best possible scenario, you're going to get back the amount that you lent out on time, minus opportunity cost, because what you could have done with that money in the interim, and minus inflation. Well, forget interest. But you're not even, back to square one. Right? Imagine if a couple of years ago, when our dollar was at parity with the American dollar, you lent somebody money, and then you got paid back now when it's, 78 cents. Right? You've lost money, and there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. So money lending is, generally speaking, a form of tzedakah. Now you end up with a situation where not only is it stuck in the best case scenario, but you're telling me I have to forgive the loan altogether come Rosh Hashanah. Thanks, I'll start lending people again next year. Right? I'm not going to lend money now. And that's a problem because it causes people to violate this mitzvah d'oraisa of lending money and the Torah's specific warning of do not fail to lend. Do not fail to lend. That was like the first time. Okay. So, what do you do? So, Hillel creates a document called a prosbul. Now, there's some debate as to what exactly Hillel was doing when he did this. Was he taking advantage of an existing loophole? Did he actually invent something? But the way a prosbul works is it's a document. Prosbul itself is a Greek term. And what it does is it assigns debts that are owed to you to a beis din that you name in the document, such that all the money owed to you is collectible by the beis din. Because the rule is that Shemitah cancels debts owed from one individual to another, not from an individual to an institution. So therefore, the loan survives. And the beis din says, well, we don't want it. You can just claim it. Don't worry about it. So that's the way that a prosbul works. The Gemara asks, how'd you get to do that? By what right did you say that money that somebody owns themselves now is going to belong to somebody else? Right? I borrowed money from somebody, and I owed it to that person. Then, come Rosh Hashanah, I don't owe it anymore. But because the Beis Din, because Hillel invented this prosbul thing, presto, now I don't owe the money. Now suddenly I do owe the money, I should say. Money that was mine now belongs to somebody else.
There's no real legal document, like a legal, agreement?
Yes, it is. But depending again on how I understand what Hillel did, it's entirely possible that this legal institution that he created was something literally he created, and he was canceling the cancellation that should have taken place. So how does he get to do that? So there are a couple of different answers. One answer is that Shemitah is only rabbinic in the second Beis HaMikdash anyway, in the time of Hillel. There's more to discuss on that front, and we'll actually touch on that in a little bit anyway. But the main approach that we see in the Gemara that we're going to be using here is the approach called Hefker based in Hefker, which means the court has the right to say that which this person owned, they no longer own. That's within their rights. How do you know they have that right? So that's what brings us to source number
person
one.
Who loaned the money,
well,
doesn't own it.
The other way around. The person who borrowed the money
doesn't.
No longer owns. And in other words, with the end of Shemitah, he no longer owns the money that he thought had been forgiven.
Oh.
He now is going to owe it to the other person. They've created a debt for him. That's effectively what's happened.
But couldn't, to avoid the whole situation, couldn't there be a free loan society, like a loan society, that I give my money to them as an institution, and they loan it out to you, and then there is no issue with the prosbul, like then it doesn't get nullified, right? If it went through somewhere
the loan
and then back to...
Right, so in your free loan society, let's say it's not end of year 7, let's say it's year 4.
Okay.
When the person pays back the money, who does it go to?
Well, they pay it back to the society, but then they know that it comes back.
Is this called money laundering?
Okay.
I mean, the question is the question is not against you. The question is, why isn't what Hillel does money laundering? That's the real question, because that's...
Well, it is. You're giving it to an institution. It's like when you give...
Are they giving
a
profit?
You're giving it to an institution, but really the institution is giving it back to you.
If you want, we could actually have a share on this, and we could go into it in depth to what type of institution it works with. I figured I was just going to mention it just as a context for source number one.
That kind of reminds me of Kirat Chametz too. That's also kind of a little bit of a loophole,
So in and of itself, Mechiras Chametz is not. And the reason I say it's not is because if you actually sell your chametz the way it was intended, which is to say, you sell it to them and they take it home and it's theirs, then it's very clearly a bona fide sale. They can eat it and so on. The Bach, if you looked at...
No one does it that way.
There's a lot of cars and a lot of offices.
What do you mean?
How
paper.
Right. So in last week's Toronto Torah, the Torian translation section, was actually on this. The Bach writing in the 17th century, 16th, 17th, something like that, said that the truth is it ought to be taken out of the home, and that's the way they were doing it, it seems, in his day, except that there were many Jews who were in the liquor business. That was a big deal. They would get liquor licenses from the government. It comes up in all sorts of areas of Jewish law. So they had these licenses, and they owned a ton, and they were not going to move it out into this fellow's house over Pesach.
Is that where the heter comes that you shouldn't sell chametz gamor, but only liquor?
So
I know they do that. They won't sell chametz gamor, but liquor they will sell.
Right. So that's a debate about the status of liquor. It's a debate about the status of liquor itself. It's a separate reason.
Like an off topic. That's what we do.
People won't sell real chametz.
You have flour left in your canister. Flour is not chametz gamor. So what is chametz gamor? Just crackers. So you don't really all that stuff. You just throw that really off. You do that too, Rabbi Tradition?
We tend to give it away.
You don't give any crackers up. I usually give it away. Or I finish it.
Yeah. I mean, how much are you... the truth is, you tend not to have a lot of chametz gamor around. Yeah, I mean, but in terms of what qualifies for chametz gamor, all interesting questions, which I will gladly refer to Rabbi.
Right. Can we do a shiur on Pesach next week instead of Yeshua?
If you wanted to, but it's going to be a little late for worrying about your chametz at that point already.
No, it's just interesting.
That's a lot of eating.
You're losing a week for us.
We have a week and a half.
Yeah, you will have a week and a half.
It will
be
enough time to get rid of the cereal.
You'll have 1 week until Bedikas Chametz. Yeah. But in terms of the liquor issue is also a separate question about how I view the status of
Pesach. I thought it was monetary value.
Right, so there's separate. There are separate considerations. But in terms of the... I don't even know where it was. No, it's just the difference between Prosbol and the sale of chametz. The sale of chametz at its core is fairly straightforward. What's novel is the fact that you can keep it in your house. And my practice always was that when I was responsible for this sort of thing, the secretary of the shul would always buy it, and I would always tell her, look, anytime you want, you can go into anybody's house, and we had people to know where people's keys were and everything else. Some people
and
actually gave
cars,
me the key.
And their
what chametz do they have in their car?
I don't know. Do you always just sell them? I'm selling the car, right?
You're not here.
She doesn't want the Cheerio under the seat.
I have like a lot of that work.
No, but in all
whatever.
Seriousness, every year I used to say I was going to take her around to people's houses just to do that, but she had no interest. That was the problem.
But you're hungry one day.
But that's the way. No, it's supposed to be a bona fide sale, and that's really, that's meant to be so. What Hillel is doing is a different league. Mm-hmm. In other words, there... The weakness of the sale of chametz is, am I serious when I do this or not? As well as the question of, does the non-Jew really have enough money to make that balloon payment after Pesach or not? Which is why in some communities, including I think here, they set up what's called an Arei of Kablan, somebody who actually is a person of great means, who is like the guarantor, such that if the non-Jew buying the chametz were to say, I want to buy it, this person would actually shell out. And they'd have to evaluate what everything is worth. And no, not
I wanted to run a crop consultant.
So what, why does the man just do that?
I'm sorry?
Because
he doesn't want your Cheerios. That's really why. He doesn't really want it. He says, you know what? Thanks, it's been nice. He makes a couple of bucks on the deal anyway. And he goes home.
Do they actually pay him? Like, you get paid?
Well, part of when you do a sale of chametz, this has nothing to do with Yeshua. This is great. That's fine. When you do a sale in general in halacha, so there's something required called a kinyan, right? Mm-hmm. You have to do an act that demonstrates some agreement. So there are different ways to do a kinyan depending on what is being purchased and who the parties are in the purchase. So that not happening. When you're dealing with this kind of a transaction in which there is money changing hands, there is also a rental of land changing hands as part of this, because he has to, as part of this, either purchase or rent land on which chametz is located. So we do multiple types of kinyanim in order to ensure that we're doing it the right way. So one is the very simple, pick up a pen type of a thing, right? That you've seen
wedding.
At weddings or wherever. Generally, you don't have the room for that.
I was told about it.
Okay. But that's... Oh, that's true. There are pictures. Okay. So that's one...
We hear things on the other side.
Got it. I suppose you hear anything over that music, but okay. But that's one type of transaction. And the other one is that money actually changes hands. So the... and then... Well, leave this out. What happens at the after Pesach? It's its own discussion. But the point is that there is money changing hands, and yes, he will end up with money. That's the upshot of all of this. So, in terms of the Pros Bowl, yeah, Pros Bowl is actually different in the sense that it's creating a new institution of a kind by doing this. And so the Gemara asks, by what authority does he do that? And that's the answer here in Source 1. Source 1 asks, Minayin Shehefker based in Haya Hefker. How do you know that when a Beis Din says something is ownerless, it actually is ownerless? Shenamar, because, they quote a pasuk from Ezra, when the Jews come back for the second Beis HaMikdash, Ezra declares, V'chol asher lo yavo l'shloshes hayamim, whoever doesn't show up in 3 days, katzas hasarim v'hazikinim, according to the plan of the officers and the elders, yocharam kol rechusho, he loses all his property. And he will be separated from the population of the exile, those who have returned. So he finds those who don't come back. By what right does Ezra take away people's property? And the answer is, Hefker Beis Din. It is legitimate for him to say, you thought you owned this, you don't own that anymore. That's one approach.
Whose property is that? The property in exile?
No, in Israel. The land they have claims to, whatever, yeah.
But they have 3 days to claim it, you're saying?
They have 3 days, right. He's generous. Rabbi Eliezer Omar Mehacha. Rabbi Eliezer gave a different source. He gives a source from our division of the land. It's from Perek Yetet. Ela hanachalos asher nachalu Elazar Kohen v'Yoshua bin Nun v'Rashei ha'avos. These are the portions that were allotted by Elazar son of Aharon, who is still around, and Yehoshua bin Nun, and Rashei ha'avot. And that's the key set of words. The heads of the fathers. So, if you would have asked me how to translate Rashei Ha'avot, I would have said it's heads of the families. That's the basic idea. You have sort of the heads of the household, and they get together, and there's somebody who's in charge of them. But the Gemara asks, V'chima Iyan Rashim Eitzel Avos. What do heads have to do with fathers? Lomar Lach, Ma Avos Manchilin Es Benehen Kol Ma She'irtzu. Just like fathers can give their sons whatever they choose, in other words, parents can give their children property as they choose. So too, the heads were empowered that they could give the nation as they chose. Meaning, they could take land that somebody here thought was going to be his and give it to somebody else. They're allowed to assign the property at their discretion. So the first ramification of dividing up the land is simply that we learn the power of Beis Din, and we have two psukim here because what Yehoshua does is stronger than let me not go there, it's too much. Let me leave it where it is. But the second issue is the impact of the division on the future. There are many mitzvos within Torah that depend on having the Jews living in their land in the fashion the Gemara describes as kol yoshvei ha'alah, when all of the inhabitants of the land are living there. And if you take a look at source number 2, the Gemara gives us one of them, and that is Yovel. Yovel is the one every 50 years when the land goes back to its original owners and so on. And the Gemara there says, Mishagalu Shevet Reuven, Beshevet Gad, Bahatsi Shevet Hamanashe, Batlu Yovelos. Reuven, Gad, and half of Manasseh, living on the eastern side of the Ardain, are the first ones to go into exile at the end of the first Beis HaMikdash. And the Gemara says, at that point, Yovel ceases. Shenamar, because the Pasuk says, Ukrasem Deror Ba'aretz L'chol Yosheveha, you shall proclaim liberty, right, from the bell. You shall proclaim liberty in the land for all of her inhabitants. That's the key line. Bizman Shekol Yosheveha Aleha, V'lo Bizman Shegalo Miktsasan, when all of the inhabitants of the land are dwelling there, not once some of them have been exiled. Once they go into Galus, they go into exile, Yovel doesn't apply. Along with Yovel, other popularly known, more popularly known mitzvos also don't apply in this same way, Well, you don't have all the Jews living in the land. So, for example, the biblical mitzvah of separating challah. Right? We separate challah anyway, but the biblical mitzvah of separating challah is when you are in the land. Not just a Jew living in the land, but when we have all the Jews there. Because the way the Torah phrases it when it presents the mitzvah is when you're in your land, that's when you're going to do this.
So why do we do it?
Because we still have it as a derabbanan. Why did they create a derabbanan for it? Probably because imagine a scenario in which the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt and people have been making bread all along without this. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, right. You know, you make bread all the time.
Forget.
Like, how are you going to educate everybody?
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like having Shabbos without an Eruv.
Right.
Right? Everybody suddenly is going to have to adjust to a whole new set of rules. Another one is, Truma and Meiser are in the same thing. Aliyah L'Regel, right? The mitzvah of going to Yerushalayim for the Tzvi Regalim, also contingent on having the Jews living in the land. Not necessarily contingent on a Beis HaMikdash, interestingly, but having the Jews living in the land.
Uncontingent. I mean, Beis HaMikdash, not Beis HaMikdash, in the land. So that's actually a mitzvah that is going to come into force as soon as the majority of Jews, which I think is coming up any day.
So that's an excellent question. That's an excellent question. At what point do we say that now these mitzvahs are back in force? I believe the majority of world Jewry does live there now. It was supposed to have happened at some point this year.
The statistics coming out didn't seem to...
Don't know.
So if you want to make an investment, now's the time to buy a permit.
It will tip the scale.
Imagine if you were the one.
It's like a million customers.
A few years ago, it made headlines when Israel became the largest population of Jews in the world. Marginally beating out Teaneck. So at that point, that was a big deal in and of itself. But becoming the majority of Jews may not be enough. And the reason I say it may not be enough is keep on reading in the Gemara in Erchin. The Gemara asks, Yachol Yehu Aleha Vehein Me'uravin. I might think that it would count if the Jews are in the land, even if they're all mixed together, Sheva Binyamin B'Yehuda, Sheva Yehuda B'Binyamin, right? Yehe Yovel Noheg. I might think Yovel will apply when all the Jews are there, even if they're in the wrong tribal portion. Talmud Lomar L'Chol Yosheveha. No, because the Torah says, for all of her inhabitants, and the key is to inhabit. Bizman She Yosheveha Kitikunan V'Lo Bizman She'en Me'uravin. When they are actually in there properly, meaning each one in, or at least some of, the right Shevet in the right portion.
Clearly we don't know who's in the
We have no clue. Right.
That is a label. Well, I don't label, right. If you're labeling it.
Well, I'm going to, but that doesn't mean anything. It could be this.
But that's a real question.
You don't know, right?
That's the problem. So, indeed, according to many authorities, therefore, the population swing doesn't matter. We need a Navi to tell us who's supposed to be in which
chilek. Just about the return of people to their land, because that's something that you actually need that for. Whereas something like taking challah, you need a majority for it to be. You know what I'm saying?
The problem is that it does, because the criteria for which mitzvos need to. The criteria for which mitzvos require kol yosheveha aleha is either a mitzvah is yovel linked, and therefore it only applies when yovel applies, or a mitzvah has in the Torah an explicit statement of when you enter your land, when you settle in your land, that's what triggers it. So challah is an example of that. So even though, you're right, challah inherently, I don't have to own land in order to have dough, nonetheless, it is biblically linked to when the Jews are actually settled. And settled is defined in this way.
We don't know whether they are or are not in their proper land, because that would involve actually finding out what tribe they're
in. Exactly the point. Exactly the point. So the truth is that Rav Soloveitchik argued that this is not a requirement anymore. And the reason is because he contends that the distribution of the land by Yehoshua is nullified by Babylonian exile. When they go into Galus, they all lose their shares and we're all scrambled. And there is no redistribution in the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash.
They don't go back to the original
place. Correct. So therefore, it won't apply, and therefore, according to some, indeed, it is possible to argue that today these mitzvot will be back and will be back in force.
Including
Eliezer Regel, all of them. It's Eliezer. Waldenberg has a tshuva on it. The Vilna Gaon, if I remember correctly, in Kol HaTor, said that it's actually triggered by even less than this. He said if you have 600,000 Jews, that's already sufficient, parallel to the number who left Mitzrayim. That's already enough. So yeah, that has all sorts of very serious halachic ramifications. Sorry?
Depending on how many Jews are in Israel.
I believe the number in Israel now is somewhere in the 5 to 6 million range. Mm-hmm.
But does that mean all Jews? Because
yes, they all count.
How do you know?
Right, so it's very tricky.
How do you do a censor?
We don't
know.
Yeah.
But
there's still Jews.
Yeah. Right. There are
Jews,
right? I mean,
can you imagine?
Conference of all years, you know. You always hear, oh, they're Jewish. Your mother was Jewish. They're really Jewish, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so we started enough trouble. That's an introduction to the division of the land in our parak. So we now move into distributing the land west of the Yarden. The opening section here, Psukim Aleph to Zion. Take a look.
We haven't read anything yet.
Vihoshua Zakein Ba Bayamim. Sorry. Sounds like Abraham, indeed. We're going to come back to that. So Yehoshua was elderly. Baba Yamim, he had entered his days. Right? What in the world does that mean? So it means he aged, but we're going to come back to this. Vayomer Hashem Elav, God said to him, Ata Zakanta Basa Bayamim, in case you didn't know, Yehoshua.
You're old.
Yeah, thanks. V'haaretz nishara harbe me'od lirishtah. And much of the land remains to be taken. Right, which we've already talked about, and maybe this is another point in favor of those who say that Yehoshua is criticized for holding back, because God actually says to him something he knows full well. Like God's making a point of it. You know, there's a lot of the land left. You didn't do it. Zos ha'aretz hanishares. Here's the land that remains, he says. Kol gililos ha'plishtim v'chol ha'gishuri. So here we're going to get into some geography. Gililot is a funny term. It can actually refer to various places, but the Radak renders it as cities. So the cities of the Plishtim and the Gishuri. The Gishuri are a problem population in the sense that they're not mentioned as one of the seven Canaanite tribes. And they have two major centers. One is in the southwest, like think Aza down toward Egypt, and one is in the way northeast, like east of the Yarden and up towards Hermon. That area. Two very different spaces, but both of them, as we'll see in this parak, are identified with the Gishuri. So he says the lands of the Plishtim and the Gishuri, meaning the southwestern Gishuri, Min HaShichor Asher Al Pnei Mitzrayim, from Shichor. Shichor is the Nile. So from the Nile that is across the face of, meaning the entrance to Egypt, Va'ad Givul Ekron Tzafona, all the way up to Ekron in the north. Ekron is a city of the Plishtim. So it doesn't mean the north, it means the northern area of that southwestern land that's identified with the Plishtim. Lakna'ani Techashev, that is all considered to be for the Kana'ani. We'll explain what that means in a little bit. Just if you want, there's a map here. This is your area you're talking about. The Gishuri are here. And you have the Plishtim running up the coast a little bit. There are five cities that we always associate with the Plishtim, which we're going to actually, I think we're actually going to, yeah, we're going to say them in the next line, so I don't have to show off. The Chamesha Sarnei Plishtim. Five Sranim of the Plishtim. What's a Saren in Hebrew today? You're familiar with the term? I think Saren is a lieutenant in the army. But the Sarnei Plishtim means the officers of the Plishtim. Ha'azati from Aza, that's one city. Ha'ashdodi, Ashdod, the second one. Ha'eshkeloni from Ashkelon, that's your third city. Ha'giti from Gat. And the Ha'ekroni, and from Ekron, the Ha'avim, and the Avim, who are the sixth of the five Plishti cities, which we have to come back to. Yes, apparently. You can read. So we have to come back to that too. Mi Teiman, call Eretz HaKna'ani, from the south, going upwards, the entire land of the Kna'ani, Umi'ara, as well as the caves, Asher Lat Sidonim, which were owned by the Sidonim. That mikra associates Sidonim with the Phoenicians. The Phoenicians are all up the Mediterranean coast. So we're still sort of clinging to that area in our boundaries. Ad Afeka, all the way up to Afeka. Afeka is another term, like Lilot, which could refer to many different places. It just means a place where water emerges. Like Ka'afikim Banegev. Ad Givul Ha'emori, all the way to the boundary of the Emori, which is way up north, up towards Lebanon. The Ha'aretz Ha'Givli, the land of the Givli, or Gevel, which is a port, a Phoenician port. V'kol ha'Levanon Mizrach HaShemesh, and all of Lebanon, east, Mibal Gad Tachas Har Hermon Ad Lebal Hamas, from Baal Gad under Har Hermon all the way to Hamas, which was a boundary already in the days of the Meraglim when the spies first came in. They went to Hamas. Kol Yoshvei Ahar, all of the dwellers of the mountains, Min HaLevanon Ad Misrafot Mayim Kol Sidonim, from Lebanon up in the north to Misrafot Mayim, which we talked about already in a previous parak, the place where they would put the water, to burn off the water and leave behind the salt. Called Sidonim, all of the Phoenicians, Anochi or Rishem Mipnei Bnei Yisrael, God says, I will conquer them before the Jews. Rak HaPileh LeYisrael B'Nachala, Kasher Tzivisicha, your job, Yehoshua, for this entire land, is to assign it to the Jews as portions, Kasher Tzivisicha, the way I told you way back when you were supposed to do. Ve'ata, and now, he says, actually, no. You have to halt there. I don't know why I broke it with Pasuk Zion. It really should break with Pasuk Vav. Okay.
But is that fair to assign the land to conquer to certain, like, those tribes are going to have problems?
That's a good question.
Unlucky tribes to get to right.
But aren't they all going to help conquer it?
Yeah. Like, why is that fair that all the other Jews got to conquer it?
So,
why not the whole division fair, I guess? That's another main question, but...
Right. And all of this it requires discussion. None of this is straightforward. But let's go through the psukim now. We've read six psukim, so let's see again what we're doing here. First of all, Yehoshua is old twice, right? He's Zakein and he's Baba Yamin. Right, so what in the world is that about? So take a look on your sheet at source number 3, please. Medrash from Bereishis Rabbah, which notes, as Ora did, that this is not the only place where Zakein Baba Yamin appears. There are actually 3 of them in Tanakh. Gimel nichtarim bezikna ubiyamim. 3 people were crowned with age and with years. Ushloshtan hayu rosh l'nisayon. All 3 of them were of the greatest experience, meaning that they were not just the greatest, but the first in a certain experience. Avraham, Yehoshua, v'David. Those are your 3. Avraham is described. Avraham zaken ba bayamim b'shem be'rachas Avraham b'kol. Yehoshua here, and then David in the beginning of Malachim Aleph, I believe, is the same.
Yeah. He has to be warmed.
First of all, is there a difference between age and years? And second of all, David had what? Age? Years? He was 70.
Apparently. Well, no, but that's that's the idea.
So, he was only 7?
David dies at the age of 70. Yeah. So look at what the Medrash does with it. Avraham Rosh La'avot. Avraham is the head of the first of the Avot, patriarchs. Yehoshua Rosh Lamalchus, Mishevet Ephraim. Yehoshua is the first of the kings from the tribe of Ephraim, because no one else was before him, and he has the status of a king in terms of what he's empowered to do. We talked about that last year. David Rosh Lamalchus, Mishevet Yehuda. And David is the head for monarchy from the house of Yehuda, because he's the first from his Shevet to be king. Amar Rabbi Acha, Yesh lecha adam shu bezikna ve'eno biyamim, biyamim ve'eno bezikna. He says sometimes you have somebody who has aged in the sense that they're already, I want a nice word, their body isn't functioning the way it used to function. The ve'eno biyamim. But they haven't actually had that many years. It's just that they've aged. Yeah, don't say deteriorate. That's one of the words I didn't want to use. Then you have b'yamim ve'eino b'zikna. You have some people who have lived many years, but you wouldn't know it. You look at them and say, oh, they're fine. Aval kan zikna kineged yamim v'yamim kineged zikna. Here, it's age appropriate to years and years appropriate to age. In other words, these three people, they were old, no matter how you sliced it. Whether you went by chronology or whether you went by wear and tear, that's another one. That's a good one. They were up there. So Nanette asks, well, wait a minute, he's only 70. And I think the answer likely is that 70 meant a different thing in David's day than it does today. That's the answer that I would give you. And especially when you consider that, you know, Abraham is 175. And he's not 175 at this point. He's only 137. But still, we're comparing somebody who is 70, and we say he's got a lot of years on him, with someone who's 137, right? Abraham, the Medrash comments that with Abraham, it doesn't say he ages until Sarah dies. So as long as Sarah's alive, he's okay. And then Sarah dies, and then he's old. So right, she was 10 years younger than him. So that's the Medrash here picks up on this redundancy of Zakein Bayamim. That's the message. Okay. The next sentence, though, starts us off on these southwestern unconquered areas, and it introduces us to the Plishtim. And the Plishtim are a problem. And the reason the Plishtim are a problem is because of the archaeologists. Anybody ever hear of this? The debate about who the Plishtim were and when they entered? When did we first find Plishtim in Tanakh? True, and they're leaving Egypt, but they're there earlier. We find it in the earliest points of Bereshit. We find mention of Plishtim. Yitzhak has issues with the Plishtim and his wells. Abraham goes to Gerar. I think even there are places identified with the Plishtim even earlier than that.
Abimelech was the king of the Plishtim, right, at the time, or no?
Abimelech. Right. So the problem is that, according to archaeologists, Plishtim do not enter Israel until somewhere around the 12th century before the Common Era, which is about 600 or so years after the time of Abraham and Yitzhak. So what are we to make of this? And the Torah calling them Plishtim. So you could give the easy answer, which is often the Torah names a place based on something that hasn't yet happened, including where events in the Torah themselves are what are going to lead to the name later on. So that's a very fairly easy answer. Like, we had a city, a place called Tirza, even though Tirza hadn't arrived yet. Tirza was one of the daughters of Tzlachat who was going to settle there. It happens quite a bit. Nachal Eshkol, we find that. However, the archaeologists may well have jumped the gun, because it seems that the Plishtim are identified in, I gave you the pasuk here in source number 4, they're identified as something called Kaftorim, who come from the seacoast of a place called Kaftor. So where is Kaftor? You don't need to look up the pasuk. It says exactly what I just told you. That's it. Okay. There's nothing terribly beyond that.
Not holding back.
Kaftorim hayotzim mi Kaftor. Yeah.
That's what it says. Avim there too.
Yes, it does. So many suggest that they came from Crete, based on certain lines in the Septuagint. And Crete has compelling evidence. They have found a clay disc, for example, in Crete that depicts a warrior with a headdress and an axe handle with a similar inscription on it. And that matches artwork found in the Philistine areas in Israel. There are shards found in Gerar, which is a capital of those early Plishtim, like with Abimelech, you know, there, going back to 1600 before the Common Era, that based on the artwork on it seems to have come from Crete. So there are associations there, including murals and so on. So that group of people from Crete, interestingly, you know what you call people from Crete?
Crete.
Don't say Cretans, no, it's not true.
Cretans?
Minoans. Oh. Yeah, go figure. So I found it on the internet. It's got to be true. So
it's
got to
be true.
So the Minoans are known to have been engaged in sea trade in the period from 2000 to 1500 before the Common Era, which is the right time for the start of the Philistine cities in Canaan. So the problem may be solved. In any case, those are the Plishtim who are frustrating Yehoshua. No one has uprooted them, and indeed they're going to frustrate generations afterwards as well. We know David has many issues with the Plishtim. And then in Pasuk Gimel, we talked about the Shichor, the Nile, and we said, Lekna'ani Techashev. Right? In sentence 3, we said, it is considered for the Kana'ani. And what that means is that the word Kana'an is a word that we often misuse. We talk about Kana'an as though all of Israel was once called Eretz Kana'an. But the truth of the matter is, Kana'an refers to the seven nations who we call the Kana'ani nations, right? Chiti, Amori, Chivi, Yebusi, right? Those are the ones who are the Kana'ani, and the Plishtim were really considered to be part of a separate land. The Plishtim in the south are different from the Kana'ani. Eretz Plesheth is actually a land in the south. It matters in a few different places in Chumash as far as where Kana'ani are and where Plishti are. But what we're saying here, as Ramban explains it, is this land in Pasuk Gimel that we've just identified from the Nile at the boundary of Egypt to the boundary of Ekron in the north, Lakna'ani Techashev, Ramban explains it used to be the land of the Kana'ani before the Plishtim moved in, as we just talked about, and took it over from the Kana'ani. And the Kana'ani kind of receded. So they are ruled by the Sarnei Plishtim. But, as we said, we're told 5 Sarnei Plishtim, and then we are told of 6 populations. So the question is, who are the Avim? And there are 2 different views. Rashi in Devarim Bechav Gimel, that pasuk that we had in source number 4 that you noted the Avim appear in, so Rashi there says they are indeed Plishtim. Well, then why is it that they're not mentioned? They don't get a Seren. So one possibility is, if you look back at that pasuk, which you're not going to do right now, it says they lived in Chatzerim. In other words, open areas. They weren't really an established city the way that the others were, these walled cities. That's one possible explanation. Another explanation comes from the Gemara in Chulin. If you take a look at source number 5, the Gemara asks, as we thought that we were very bright, we came up with this question. Amar Hamisha v'chashiv shisa. The pasuk said there were 5, but then it listed 6. So Amar Rabbi Yonasan, Aron ki shelahen Hamisha. Rabbi Yonasan said they only had 5 leaders. The answer is that they didn't rank having one of these great leaders. So that's the first approach. Second approach is to say they're actually not Plishtim. This group of Avim is a different population that happens to be around the same area, but they're not getting a ruler in this ruling council of the 5 Sarnei Plishtim. The Gemara continues, Upliga de Rav, Rav Yonasan's statement disagrees with that of Rav. Da'amar Rav, because Rav said, Avim miteman ba'u. The Avim came from the south. They moved into this land, but they weren't Plishtim. The Plishtim were the sea people who came from Crete. The Avim moved up from the south. Tanya Nami Hachi, I have a brisa supporting that. Avim miteman ba'u, the Avim came from the south. V'lama nikrashman Avim, where did they get the name Avim from? A few different suggestions. She'ivsu es mikoman, because they corrupted their place. Avim ivtu. Davar acher Avim, she'ivu le'elahut harbei, or le'elahot harbei. They desired many gods, and it's a play on words, even though one has an ayin and one has an aleph, and therefore they would have pronounced them differently, nonetheless. Or davar acher, third approach, Avim shekol haro'eh otam ochaz to avit, anybody who saw them was gripped by trembling, which is called avit. So it's a play on words there as well, and then Gemara goes on to say they had many teeth, and they were very scary. But that's a second approach, is that they're in fact not Plishtim. Ramban, in source number 6, has the same approach, that they're not Plishtim. He suggests that they were actually the Chivi. Chivi became Avim. The Chet itself is not really a Chet, remember, their Chet is pronounced more like a Hey, very close to a Hey. And so he suggests that one warped into the other via dialects. He also notes that the Chivi is a snake. That's what Chivi means. Chivia is a snake. And he says, Avim suggests crooked, as we saw for the translations before. So maybe the snake and crooked, and therefore they sort of warped one name into the other. So there are 2 different schools of thought, all both aimed at solving the problem of why there are only 5 Sarnei Plishtim in a pasuk that mentions six populations. Okay. So this area along the shore is unconquered, right? Because they conquered the middle of the land, right? They took care of all of that. But the area on the shore was unconquered, working your way from the south all the way up north with the Phoenicians, up to the area of the north then going east.
They don't give an eastern boundary, though, do they?
It just says going east, right? Mizrach HaShamesh. That's the, and then the area that we're going to see, we'll see the boundary in the next sequence of Psukim. And he says to Yoshua, I want you to divide it up, and then I'll take care of the conquest. So why does he want Yoshua to divide it up if they're not going to conquer it now anyway? Two explanations from Abarbanel. One, he says each clan will be responsible then to conquer its own area. Right? If you just say, here's a big land, nation, go out and conquer it. So, yeah, someone else will take care of it. I'm busy right now. But if each clan is actually responsible for a space, then they'll do it, bless you.
They already conquered part of it.
So this area in the middle.
Right, so the people that are settling there now don't have to do anything.
They can help the other people.
Right. They
have to help each other.
They can help. But yes, you're right. The you know, in the hypothetical world that we moved into Shoftim, you'd see there that what happens is some tribes call on other tribes to help them with some of the wars. But yes, that's a problem.
Right, like the tribes that have passed,
right.
Some like
yeah.
Well, they had everyone's help regardless. They didn't have to call upon anyone.
Yeah, and the ones on east of the Yarden also. Everybody conquered that together.
Right.
But it also been in God. I mean, they had promised that they were going to...
And they're still here.
Right.
Yeah,
they're
but they promised they would conquer the whole land before they went back.
Okay. Yes. And they're not going back yet.
Okay.
Not until the end of the book. Mind you, they still want to conquer the whole land. But yeah, I don't want to spoil too much from the ending.
Couldn't it also be that the reason that they have to do it now, or they're mentioning it now, is tying into the whole that he's old and he won't be around much longer?
Why are they mentioning which now? This is the bulk of the book. What we're about to do now is going to run through chapter 19.
Didn't we just ask why is he talking about dividing it up now if they're not going to be...
Well, no, our question is, why does Hashem tell him divide it up when it hasn't been conquered yet? He says, divide it up and we'll worry about the conquest later.
Because he won't be around, because he's old.
Got it. So Hashem wants Yoshua specifically to be the one to do the division. So he says, let me have him divide it up now, because if we wait...
That's my
answer.
But he also wants him to do the conquest, and he's not going to finish that.
Right, well, maybe there's some reason why he wants him. Maybe because Yoshua has credibility that others don't have.
So he has to establish the rule. But do they ever conquer the Plishti land? Like, even in the times of the last thing, it wasn't conquered.
Right, so the Plishti land is forever a problem.
They never conquered
to this day. But in terms of the question of why Yehoshua, we also find, so far in Sefer Yehoshua, and we're more than halfway through, you notice that the nation has not gotten involved in Avodah Zarah at all?
Yet.
No idolatry has shown up, and no idolatry will show up in this book. Not until you get to Shoftim. There is something about Yehoshua as Moshe's student that maybe, yes, maybe Hashem says, I want Yehoshua to be the one to divide this up.
But Yehoshua is charged with dividing the land and conquering the land, right?
Yeah.
So maybe Hashem's trying to tell him that, I understand you're not going to get to finish the conquering, but still do the division.
Yeah. Right, the only question is, why?
Yeah.
What's the value of dividing it if they don't actually control
maybe
it?
Maybe he's trying to tell him that, even
we're
if they're
excited.
Right, like at least you
looking
should
forward to it.
At least you should fulfill one of your
maybe.
It's funny because like Moshe
takes them but doesn't get over and here now Yeshua is dividing it but isn't gonna live to come, you know,
yeah.
Like that's
yes.
They're always not quite getting to the end.
Right. The difference is that in Moshe's case, he was ready to do it and Hashem took it away from him.
Right.
In Yeshua's case, we don't know of any such thing.
Right.
Yeah. But yes, it's an interesting parallel.
Yeah.
The other benefit that Abarbanel identifies is that if the Jews are going to be living around the land this way, that prevents the sort of thing that happened in the previous Prakim, where all of these tribes band together to attack the Jews. Now, the Jews are everywhere.
Well, they can't leave
granted, they're
settled.
Not in control of it.
So if they leave it unsettled, they're going to lose it again.
But they're not. There are Jews living in the central part also. Everyone gets...
How can they live there if they haven't conquered it?
What did that mean?
But there are portions that are conquered. That yeah, part. Like let's say Yehuda gets that part with Plishtim, right? Well, there are areas that they have conquered of that
within
part.
That part.
Well, and not just that. Realistically, in those days, the fact that there were, you know, fill in the blank, Yebusi living here, didn't mean that you couldn't be living right next door. Yeah. And, you know, as long as they didn't attack you,
right?
You know, you're okay. So yes, they could be in these spaces and be a presence
space,
there.
But not control the whole space.
Well, maybe he wanted them to realize they have to be a presence there.
Maybe.
This is their way of forcing them out of just...
Meaning, because if they're not a presence there, then they're going to come and reclaim it. And everything will be back in square one. Meaning, if the Jewish people don't settle, even though they haven't finished conquering, if they don't settle what they've conquered, then the other nations are just going to come back and take it back. So maybe he's trying to express that it's important to settle, even though we haven't finished conquering.
Right. Maybe.
All these guys are dead, right? So
there's still other people.
There's other nations.
Yeah, there. Like the Plishti that we're talking about. They were involved in this.
All the nations are dead, or all the kings?
No, the kings.
Just the kings.
And you know, one king is dead, a new king is appointed.
Yeah.
Right. There's a new Yavin in Chatzor or whatever it is. Another idea that occurs to me off of what you're saying is it sort of has a parallel going back to the beginning of Chumash altogether. When Hashem gives this mission to Adam and Chava, right, he says, Puruvu umil u'es ha'aretz v'chivshua, fill the land and conquer it. So he's telling them, I want you to fill land. I think I mentioned once before, it was a hero or a different share, I forget. But I read a very interesting article that pointed out that Adam and Chava get in trouble because they didn't do mil u'es ha'aretz v'chivshua, meaning, had they left the garden to go out into the world, they wouldn't have ended up eating from the fruit. They have a mission of going out, and they didn't. They stayed in the garden. It was a very interesting take on it. It was an interesting article altogether. So they're being told, I want you to fill this land. Don't stay in the safe space that's been carved out, but get out there and do. So that's another possible explanation. Okay. So they're told that they are to divide up this land, and then we're told, we got started late, so I think we're already at, are we? This doesn't have a clock, just a timer. Yeah, alright, so we'll pick up with that. The only question is, what to do next week, if you want.